Okay, our last speaker, I'll introduce her as Ms. Paris. Ms. Paris, who soon will become Dr. Paris. They just told me that she got accepted to medical school, so congratulations to her for that. And the title of her talk is Physician Assisted Suicide and Examination of Ethics and Dignity at the End of Life.
Thank you for that introduction, and thank you all for persevering with me through to this last talk before dinner. This is a little bit of a heavy topic to end the day on, but hopefully it will prove thought-provoking. So the Hippocratic Oath, dating back to around 400 BC and still commonly acknowledged by physicians today, manifests, "I will neither give a deadly drug to anybody who asked for it, nor will I make a suggestion to this effect." This oath, which has been considered the ethical guide for conduct in the medical field for centuries, clearly opposes physician-assisted suicide, or PAS. However, on April 8th of this year, legislation was passed to legalize PAS in Hawaii, and in November of 2016, it was legalized in Colorado. And within the past 25 years, it's become legal in 7 states and DC. So clearly, this is a current topic. The question is, then, did those today who support PAS offer a superior ethical argument adequate to overturn the long-standing paradigm set forth in the Hippocratic Oath? So in order to answer this question, we are going to look at some relevant background information regarding PAS in the United States. We are going to evaluate the strength and integrity of the leading arguments both for and against its use. And finally, we are going to consult the Bible and Christian doctrine in order to identify the stance that is required by a biblical worldview. It cannot be denied that much is at stake pending the outcome of this ethical conversation. At a minimum, a patient's freedom to choose and right to die are compromised when PAS is condemned, but a reevaluation of the role of a physician, and much more significantly, a reevaluation of the axiom of the sanctity of life, are necessitated if it is allowed. So therefore, it is vitally important that we reach an ethical conclusion. At present, all the legislation in the U.S. legalizing PAS sets forth similar requirements to make someone eligible and presents a similar procedure that must be followed. To be eligible, the patient must be a mentally competent adult over the age of 18 and a resident of a state where PAS is legal. The patient must be diagnosed with a terminal illness and given 6 months or less to live. Both the diagnosis and the prognosis must be confirmed by 2 licensed physicians. Finally, the patient must be capable of self-administering the lethal drug without any assistance. In order to obtain the lethal medication, the patient must submit 2 oral requests separated by at least 15 days and 1 written request. 2 people must witness the written request, attesting to the fact the patient is competent and voluntarily requesting the prescription without any coercion. Next, both physicians must attest to the fact that the patient has the mental capacity to make an informed decision. If there is any doubt about the patient's mental status, he or she must pass an evaluation by a licensed psychiatrist or psychologist to determine mental competency before a prescription can be given. Finally, after making the written request, the patient must wait at least 48 hours before filling the prescription. The request may be rescinded at any time, and the process must be stopped if any coercion is suspected or evidenced. If someone is coercive, they are guilty of a felony and subject to criminal penalties. Ultimately, all these requirements and regulations are put in place to protect the patient against coercion and abuse. So given that a prognosis of 6 months or less to live is a requirement for eligibility, I want to look quickly at how a doctor comes up with this time frame. Typically, a prognosis is estimated by using statistics about groups of people with the same disease. Then mathematical modeling techniques allow the physician to make a reasonable estimate about what the outcome will be for a specific patient. However, the prognosis is based off group statistics, and it is not always easy to apply the data to individuals. No two patients will respond in exactly the same way, thus a prognosis is typically considered a median estimate. So in other words, if a 6-month prognosis is given, this means that after 6 months, about half of the patients will be alive and half of them will have passed away. So many factors must be taken into consideration when prognosticating, including age, comorbidities, etc. And as new symptoms emerge, the prognosis can be refined. The closer a person gets to death, the more accurate a prognosis that can be made. Research shows that doctors tend to be overly optimistic when giving a prognosis, and one study shows that this is the case as much as 63% of the time. Yet while most predictions are too long, a significant minority of patients do outlive their prognosis, and sometimes by significant lengths. So thus it is important to note that while a prognosis provides valuable insight into the likely course of a disease, it can in no way provide an exact expiration date. Next, I want to look a little bit at how the drugs most often prescribed in PAS bring about death. So there are no rules in the US stating which drugs may or may not be used, but the drug of choice is often a barbiturate, such as sacropento or phenobarbital, or a cocktail of drugs, which often includes a barbiturate. A lethal dose of these drugs costs anywhere from $400 to $15,000. Many health insurances, including Medicaid, do not cover the costs of these drugs. Barbiturates are a class of synthetic drugs derived from barbituric acid that depress the central nervous system. They function by enhancing the action of the neurotransmitter GABA by binding to a site on the GABA-A receptor chloride channel, which increases the time that the chlorine ion pore is open and prolongs GABA's postsynaptic inhibitory effects in the thalamus. Barbiturates are often used in PAS because they depress the sensory cortex and decrease motor activity, producing drowsiness, sedation, and hypnosis, and putting people into a comatose state. They produce feelings of tranquility and euphoria, and people are often described as peacefully falling asleep before dying a painless, anxiety-free death. However, there are exceptions in which patients who choose PAS experience negative complications, such as muscle spasms, nausea, vomiting, confusion, a long delay between taking the drug and death, failure to induce a coma, waking up from a coma, and failure to cause death. So some studies show that in as many as 16% of cases, the drug does not work as expected. So while death by barbiturates is commonly peaceful and painless, it certainly cannot be guaranteed. So now that we understand a little bit more about how PAS works, I want to jump into the ethical discussion. Those in favor of PAS most often cite principles such as autonomy, self-determination, and the right to die to defend their position. Autonomy refers to a person's rational capacity for self-governance or self-determination. People have a desire and a right to make the important decisions in their lives. So, if we are to respect autonomy, we must respect a person's autonomous choices about the end of his life, including if his choice is PAS. We should not force people to suffer intolerable pain. Autonomous persons have the right to die if they so choose. But those opposed to PAS would counter this argument by appealing to the value of life and the fact that physical pain is not one of the primary reasons that someone chooses PAS. In fact, pain is one of the least cited reasons for requests of assisted suicide. A case study examining the reasons people desire PAS indicated that neither the presence nor the intensity of pain were in any way associated with the desire for a hastened death. Besides, thanks to advances in pain management and palliative care, almost all pain can be eliminated, and if not eliminated, significantly reduced. So rather than killing patients, physicians should kill pain. On the contrary, advocates of PAS argue that while palliative care can reduce the suffering of terminal patients, it cannot provide total relief from side effects such as nausea, sedation, and confusion. Nobody wants to spend their last days in the relative comfort of palliative care. Furthermore, even just the fear of increasing pain, discomfort, and dependence is more than enough to burden patients. Research suggests that only about 60% of patients who receive a lethal prescription end up using it, indicating that simply the knowledge that it is available is comforting. However, many argue that legalizing PAS sends the message that if you can't deal with your pain and your problems, go ahead and kill yourself. Rather than taking this approach, physicians and society at large ought to do everything they can to not only alleviate pain, but also to provide psychological, emotional, and spiritual support. Studies show that most requests for PAS are based on depression and fear. When PAS is legal, depression may go undiagnosed. But even in patients who are dying, depression can and should be treated. Research seems to indicate that patients with new illnesses and disabilities often go through an initial phase of despondency, but with time they will adapt, their desire for a hastened death will dissipate, and they will find tremendous satisfaction in their life. In addition to depression, spiritual well-being and social support also influence a person's desire for assisted suicide. Rather than killing people, end-of-life care needs to focus on caring for the entire well-being of the patient and his loved ones. Nevertheless, proponents argue that people do not choose PAS because of the pain, physical or otherwise, but because of the indignity of being helpless and wholly dependent on others. Nobody wants the last memory loved ones have of them to be the helpless, wasted away version of themselves. It is extremely important to patients to retain control over themselves and their dignity in their final days. A central aspect of dignity lies in a person's self-determination. If a terminal patient wants to die with dignity, let him die. Yet many would claim that this attitude misses the point. Human dignity does not depend on what a person can or cannot do, but on what a person is. Being dependent on others is not undignified. Has society devolved to the point that needing help from others justifies suicide? Anything less than compassionate care until the very end falls short of what human dignity requires. The American Life League proclaims that every suicide, and especially an assisted suicide, represents a failure of the human community to affirm the value of a person's life. Physicians should care for patients as they die a dignified death of natural causes, not assist in their suicide. The view that PAS is an acceptable end-of-life decision promotes the idea that those who are sick and disabled are not people deserving of love, but burdens to be dealt with. To the contrary, those who support PAS would argue this the other way. Nobody wants to be a burden. They want to be remembered as the loved spouse, parent, etc. they were. It's not about the so-called sanctity of life, but the quality of life. There comes a point when the impairments and suffering endured in the last stages of life decrease the quality of life such that it is no longer worth living. At the end, maintaining the quality and dignity of one's life is more important than the desire to merely extend one's life. So that's the principle of autonomy. A patient ought to be able to decide for himself whether his life retains sufficient quality to make it worth living. Additionally, advocates of PAS appeal to the principles of mercy and beneficence. Despite the best possible palliative care, to deny the fact that people suffer as they are dying is an illusion, and there comes a time when attempts to prolong life are not compassionate or beneficial. In order to practice mercy, we must recognize that when the time comes, euthanasia may be the only way to free people from their agony. As such, respecting a patient's choice for PAS is the best care we can give. Therefore, in cases of incurable and unbearable pain, beneficence, or the principle that we should do good and avoid harm, is satisfied. If an autonomous patient makes a request to die, then PAS is well within the bounds of moral conduct. In fact, those who support PAS often follow a utilitarian view of ethics because a patient's decision to end life at his request in order to avoid suffering produces the most good for the most people. Conversely, those who observe a Kantian code of ethics are appalled by the notion of PAS because it treats people as objects and destroys personhood. Plus, it makes physicians accessories to murder. In many states, intentionally assisting someone in the act of committing suicide is considered manslaughter or even a felony. To assume that intentionally assisting a suicide is ethical so long as a physician is the one doing the assisting is absurd. To call it physician-assisted suicide is a euphemism and corrupts the practice of medicine and the role of a physician. The American Medical Association rejects physician-assisted suicide because they believe it to be fundamentally incompatible with the physician's role as healer. Doctors go to great lengths to alleviate pain and prolong life, so when a patient asks his doctor to hasten his death, it places undue burden on the doctor. Furthermore, it negatively affects the view of physicians as healers and patient advocates. Proponents of PAS would counter these arguments by stressing that a physician's obligation is not only to preserve life, but also to minimize suffering. When the only way to eliminate suffering is to end life, that may be the merciful thing to do, and is therefore the physician's obligation. Regardless, there are no laws requiring a physician to participate in assisted suicide against his desire. Finally, those against PAS often make the slippery slope argument that allowing assisted suicide opens the door for abuse and exploitation. The monetary factor alone may be enough to coerce people to choose assisted suicide over other end-of-life options. The cost of medication prescribed for those who request PAS is likely much less than the cost of 6 months of palliative and/or hospice care, and this would put the economically disadvantaged at great risk. Furthermore, if compassion demands that we help suffering patients kill themselves, then it follows that the physically disabled, suffering infants, and the mentally incompetent should not be denied a compassionate release from suffering and indignity. Thus, the legalization of PAS might be considered one step toward the legalization of euthanasia at large. However, advocates affirm that there is no reason to believe that PAS will necessarily lead to involuntary euthanasia. In fact, there is no evidence that legalizing PAS has had a disproportionate influence over disadvantaged or vulnerable people. Besides, assisted suicides will take place whether it is legal or not. So there you have it. Physician-assisted suicide is a form of euthanasia. The word euthanasia comes from the Greek words eu and thanatos, meaning good death, and that is precisely what supporters claim it is. However, opponents believe it instead results in harm and endangers personhood. The arguments for and against PAS are far and wide, but what it seems to come down to is how a person defines human dignity and what he values more, autonomy and the perceived quality of life, or humanity in the endowed sanctity of life. Personally, I believe the practice of PAS to be deplorable and extremely tragic. I have great compassion for those who are suffering with a terminal disease, and that's part of why I want to become a doctor. I know the progressive debilitation that accompanies a terminal disease must be unimaginable. I can't relate to what they endure. But I do not believe that suffering alone is enough to warrant the premature termination of a human life. I do not agree with arguments that allow PAS because it is considered dignified and permits a person to maintain his desired quality of life. The Declaration of Independence holds it to be self-evident truth that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, and that one of these rights is the right to life. In defending the right to life, the authors of the Declaration recognize that human life is exceptionally valuable. If life is valuable in and of itself, which I believe to be the case, then it follows that dignity is intrinsic to life. Thus, a person's dignity is not associated with his quality of life, but with the simple fact that he has life. No terminal illness, pain, or disability can take away that dignity. Nor do I agree with arguments that appeal to autonomy and the claim that an individual has the right to die if he so chooses. While it is important to respect a patient's wishes when he refuses a treatment he does not want, I do not believe that he can demand a treatment which will kill him. A right to life does not produce a right to die upon request. When a person in the general population commits suicide, it is considered a tragedy by society. Why would a suicide because of a terminal illness be any less tragic? Ultimately, I disagree with the practice of PAS because I believe it is utterly inconsistent with the biblical worldview and God's plan for humanity. While suicide may not be directly condemned in the Bible, it is clearly commanded that you shall not murder, and killing yourself is a form of murder because it involves the unjust termination of a human life. The Bible continually supports the concept of the sanctity of life, which has its roots in the fact that humans are image bearers of God. The psalmist proclaims, "For you formed my inward parts, you knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made." In Ephesians 2:10, Paul tells us that we are God's workmanship. Clearly, God cares about the people he created. Our lives are valuable to him and belong to him. Nobody, not even our own self, has the right, for any reason, to take what belongs to God. Additionally, Christian doctrine has always denounced suicide. In the 4th century, St. Augustine wrote extensively on the issue. He found it significant that the Bible never makes suicide lawful. He also referenced the story of Job, who, amidst terrible suffering, maintained his moral integrity and did not end his own life. In his Summa Theologica, Thomas Aquinas argued that to bring death upon oneself in order to escape the afflictions of this life is to adopt a greater evil in order to avoid a lesser. Even Dante the poet considered suicide a sin. He reserved this 7th layer of hell, below the greedy and the murderers, for those who had killed themselves. In more modern times, Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote, "God has reserved to himself the right to determine the end of life, because he alone knows the goal to which it is his will to lead it." These doctrines refer to suicide in general, but can also apply to instances of physician-assisted suicide. In fact, Augustine wrote in the Gospel of Life, "It is never licit to kill another, even if he should wish it, indeed if he request it, because hanging between life and death, he begs for help in freeing the soul struggling against the bonds of the body and longing to be released. Nor is it less even when a sick person is no longer able to live. So this excerpt is remarkably relevant to the issue. So I believe that Christian doctrine throughout the centuries makes it abundantly clear that PIS is contrary to God's plan. In addition, I believe the Bible teaches us to care for those who are in need, which includes the terminally ill and dying. Jesus commands us to love our neighbor as ourself. Philippians 2:4 says, "Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also the interests of others." In 1 Timothy 5:8, we are warned, "But if anyone does not provide for his relatives, even as they are dying, and especially for members of his household, he is denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever." Matthew's gospel teaches us that when we care for the sick and the least of these, we are caring for Jesus himself. Enabling terminally ill patients to kill themselves is the opposite of caring for each other, carrying each other's burdens, and loving our neighbors. God is the Father of compassion and the God of all comfort. If we do not care for terminally ill patients in their time of need by showing them compassion and comforting them, then I believe that we are failing to live according to God's standards. PAS is tempting because it has the potential to eliminate suffering, and no one wants to suffer or watch those that care about suffer. But suffering, as it is presented in the Bible, is not necessarily a negative thing. Through Jesus' suffering, salvation was accomplished. Through suffering, God reveals himself to us and to the nations. Paul says that we should glory in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance character, and character hope. As Christians, we can be reassured that after we suffer for a little while, God will restore us and make us strong. The suffering we face now is nothing compared to the glory that will be revealed to us. Instead of trying to eliminate the suffering of the terminally ill by assisting them in suicide, I believe we ought to view their suffering as an opportunity for God to be glorified. The psalmist proclaims, "Your eyes saw my unformed substance. In your book were written, every one of them, the days that were formed for me." God has a plan for our lives and a plan for each of our days. Even in the midst of suffering, even when a patient has days left to live, he is still valuable in God's sight. And if God values the lives of the terminally ill, then so should we. So it is on these grounds and in consideration of the aforementioned arguments that I believe physician-assisted suicide to be ethically impermissible. Thank you.
Chooses to stop eating and drinking. Okay? And what do you call that? As someone caring for that individual, you can't. Do you want to force food and fluids on them? Do you want to maintain their life when they clearly are saying, "I'm giving up. I'm ready to go." In essence, do you start an IV on them to keep them fluid? What do you do? I think that's an interesting situation where the patient is basically saying, sort of passively, "I'm ready to die." And I think that's one of the situations that's sort of in that very gray area that I think, as a caregiver, we have to be very careful about.
Yeah, I definitely agree. So I wanted to specifically limit this presentation to cases that are in that gray area where a person is requesting a prescription. And I think once you do get in that gray area, it's really, really difficult to say. You can argue that they are refusing a treatment, which I think that an autonomous patient has the right to do. But I think that that depends upon them being mentally competent and having the mental capacity to make an informed decision. And some people might argue that severe depression would take away that capacity. So I don't want to take a solid stance on that in any direction because it is very difficult to evaluate.
Die with dignity. And on top of that, if So, should it be assisted? And the last question would be, should it be by a physician? I wonder whether you would agree and whether there is like more separated or distinct discussions on.
Yeah, I think those are all relevant questions. So I'll start with the last one, whether it should be a physician doing the assisting. I know that there are certainly people out there who believe that this would be an acceptable practice if it wasn't a physician doing it. They think that that conflates the image that we have of doctors, and so they would say, well, perhaps we could have a person whose job it is to be a licensed end-of-life decisions, assisted suicide, some sort of professional, that is separate from a physician, and that is their job. And some people with that stipulation think that then it is okay if a doctor is not doing it. As for the other questions, you're right, it does matter how do we define dignity. Is suicide dignified, whether it's terminal illness related or not? That's a question that I know a lot of people have different answers to. But coming from a Christian worldview, I don't think that that is per se that is a dignified death. You could say that there is indignity in an elderly person needing, or a terminally ill person needing help with simple things like going to the bathroom, etc. But is it undignified for an infant to need help with those things? I would say no. What about a disabled person needing help with those things? Again, it's not undignified for them. And so while coming from a healthy life where we can do all of these things autonomously for our own and having to go to that state, I can't imagine being in that position. It must be really awful. But I don't think that that is undignified in and of itself. And then I can't remember what the third thing you said was.
So the second one is whether, so for instance, a patient just decides to commit a suicide without assistance, then someone can ask. So when you discuss about physician-assisted suicide, and then the second layer would be whether it should be assisted or would you allow someone to kill him or herself, even if you don't agree that it should be assisted yet?
Yeah, so that's a difficult issue as well. I know there are multiple states where assisting someone in a suicide is a felony, a criminal act. And that's if you're directly assisting. I don't know what the legislation is regarding if you know about it, but you don't do anything to stop or to stop it or to assist it. I don't know necessarily where the U.S. stands on that. But I personally think that allowing someone to commit suicide is just as bad as assisting them in it. If you know about it, if you know that's what they're trying to do, then I think we should take every action we can to try to eliminate that.
My question would be kind of similar to the comment and question of the other gentleman over there, but I'll kind of phrase it differently. Do you consider the living will concept of stating it out ahead of time that you deny, refuse assistance in living, feeding tubes and things like that, do you consider that to be suicide?
No, I wouldn't. So this is, again, a little bit different than the issue of the black area, black and white area that I was trying to stick into. But in an advanced directive, if a person wants to refuse treatments, I think that is okay. So perhaps I wasn't as clear as I meant to be, but I think that...
You were clear. I thought I was going somewhere else.
Yeah, so I think, refusing a treatment is okay, but demanding a treatment that will kill you, I think, is very different. Yeah, I think that's true, which is another reason why making it legal, I think, makes it more accessible and more people might view it as dignified, whereas if it wasn't legal, then it might have a different approach. So that's another reason why I'm against it in general.
Just a quick comment. Thank you for that very much. the presentation kind of focused on the autonomy of the individual and kind of arguments from that perspective. There's also a broader view where we're created for relationship. And so I go back to the pictures that you showed of the two hand in hand, where entering into relationship includes last days where suffering is a part of it. And this is Leon Kassner's bioethicist kind of fleshes this out and says, actually, it's more dignified for an individual to allow those he or she loves to enter into that part of those last days of life than it would be to make the autonomous choice to end a life. So I think there's considerations that go beyond simply the autonomous choice, yes or no, that should be part of the perspective as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I mentioned briefly that this might put an undue burden on physicians. But what about the patient's family members? If that's not what they want, if they don't want their family member to kill themselves, et cetera, that I can't imagine being in that position. They have no right to stop them. And so I don't think we can say that this will reduce suffering and bring about the most good for the most people, because that may not be the case.
Right. Well, thank you very much. That was great.